calls the case of Baca versus Department of Army, 199536. And you will note that Judge Seymour is not physically present for the arguments today. She is vouching in. She will participate fully in the decision, will listen to the recording of oral argument, and will participate just as fully as if she were here today. With that, we'll hear from the appellant.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Andrew Indahl. I represent the petitioner, Larry Baca. Mr. Baca was literally fired for investigating an incident of workplace violence. And there's no question that that's why he was fired, because that's charge two on his termination paperwork.
Could you raise that up?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay,
I apologize.
Thank you.
It's my...
Maybe even higher? Sufficient?
Sure.
He was literally fired for investigating the incident of workplace violence, and we know that because that's charge two on his termination report, that he was trying to get information from an eyewitness.
Well, what it is that the charge was that he spent, I think, 3 hours trying to get Mr. Huell to give the testimony that he wanted him to give, and they were concerned that that was coercive behavior.
Yes, Your Honor, that was the charge. The evidence at the hearing from Mr. Holtz was very contradictory to that. It was Mr. Bach wanted me to write a statement. I guess, in fact, I didn't really want to write what I heard, what I thought I heard, and I didn't want to do it at that time. So,
how is that contrary to the fact that he was in there for 3 hours trying to browbeat him into giving him favorable testimony?
There was no testimony from Mr. Holtz at that time. Mr. Holtz did not say that. Someone else claimed that from across the wall. But Mr. Holtz's testimony was very simple. Mr. Holtz's testimony was he asked me to make a statement, so he made a statement. That was his. The government, if it wanted to prove that there was this browbeating effort, it could have done that because it had Mr. Holtz in the courtroom. But it failed to do that. There's really no way to prove one way or the other how long it happened. But Mr. Holtz's testimony is not supporting the conclusion that it was 3 hours.
If the court were to find that there was substantial evidence to support a finding that that Mr. Baca had intimidated Mr. Holtz, could that still be protected conduct, or would that preclude a finding of protected conduct? In other words, is it protected in order to intimidate a third party to give testimony?
The law that I've seen is not particularly clear on whether you can engage in protected activity. I haven't seen it. I've seen there's some in which it becomes coercive.
Well, I'm assuming that it is coercive, or intimidating. So are you affirmatively arguing that it still would be protected if it were intimidation, or are you not going that far?
My position would be that it would still be protected to be intimidating, provided that you're not intimidating in an effort to make a person write a false statement.
Well,
you order a person to state, here's what I saw happen, but you cannot order them to say something false. And there's no evidence that Mr. Baca attempted to make anything false.
Well, you would agree you have to lawfully assist the other individual.
Yes.
Okay, so if we were to conclude that lawfully means not intimidate them, then we would have to rule against you, wouldn't we?
I would not agree with that because there is no evidence supporting any intimidation of Mr. Holtz. Mr. Holtz's testimony does not support the finding of intimidation.
Mr. Hull's testimony also doesn't support Mr. Baca's testimony of what happened.
That's correct. But what we have is a lot of corroboration that it actually occurred, that he actually suffered a battery, that contradicts Mr. Hull's testimony. There was, that's my the main point from the deep case, I believe, is that when there is corroboration for a reasonable belief, it has to be considered. The administrative judge in this case disregarded it.
Well, doesn't it have to be information that was available to Mr. Baca at the time?
No. It corroborates the reasonable belief. So the information known to him at the time was he was physically present, he saw it happen, and the victim of the battery reported it and went home. That, is enough to give you a reasonable belief that the battery occurred. However, there's a lot of corroboration that takes it beyond that level, which had to be considered.
Well, the finding of the administrative judge was that Mr. Baca didn't actually or reasonably believe that a battery occurred. If we find there's substantial evidence in the record to support that, aren't we done?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because he applied the wrong standard for what a reasonable belief is. Reasonable belief is facts known to the appellant that would cause a reasonable person to believe that the misconduct had occurred, and the judge is not engaging in that analysis at all. He did not do that. He asked whether he believed the allegation was plausible, which under the...
Well, he did more than that. He said they're not plausible and you didn't believe it.
Right. And in order to do that, he completely disregarded all the corroboration that actually happened. So what he's done is, if I can offer an analogy, if I'm in a 7-Eleven and I'm present for a robbery and I physically see it, and there's surveillance equipment that shows the robbery and shows me there, then for some reason I need to prove that I have a reason to believe that the robbery occurred. What this judge did was he excluded the video evidence that the robbery actually occurred and that I was actually there, and then he said, I don't believe you. And that's deeply, deeply improper. If we have evidence that it actually occurred, you cannot then ignore that evidence and then discredit the testimony of the person who was there.
What's the evidence that it actually occurred?
The medical records from the VA.
Well, the medical records don't really... what in the medical records do you point to?
The fact that he's reporting, Mr. Albizu is reporting to a medical professional at the time, I was injured when a back woman doorknob hit me in the back, and he was given 10 days of sick.
He said he had a sore back, but he never said that I was battered.
Yes, he did, but multiple times.
And he also didn't produce a picture, despite being requested specifically by the AJ to come up with that picture.
That's correct, sir. We were not able to find a picture. However, we have emails coming in which Mr. Albizrez had heard, and he said repeatedly to the base commander, I was assaulted and I was battered in the workplace, and something needs to be done about this. We had his undisputed testimony that he suffered that battery, that he went to the police, that he went to the doctor, what doctor he spoke with, what treatment he received, and that he was still in chiropractor's care a few months later.
Even if he were battered, how would the administrative judge have lacked substantial evidence to find that Mr. Baca could not and did not see the doorknob hit him from where he was standing?
He did not do that analysis. He did not ask what facts were known to Mr. Baca. And under Drake, that's what's improper. He did not say, what did Mr. Baca know? What did Mr. Baca see? He takes the position of God, standing aside and asking himself, what did life know? What he needed to do and what happened in the Drake case was, you have to identify what the facts were known to him and would the reasonable person believe that misconduct had occurred under those circumstances. Well, here's the facts that he did not analyze, that he needed to analyze, are that he was physically present, that he heard two sounds, and that he was told by the victim, I'm going home because I was injured. I don't see how that's not a reasonable belief that it's not occurred. How is it possible to not reasonably believe it when the victim is telling him, I just got hurt and I need to go?
Well, he's saying that he physically saw it, which is a little different than whether or not he found out afterward.
Well, both of those facts go together.
Okay.
He had a reasonable belief that the misconduct occurred because A, he saw it, and B, the victim told him, I got hurt when I'm going home. So on the basis of those two facts, the judge needed to do an analysis and say, could a reasonable person believe that misconduct occurred under those circumstances, and he did not do that? And his failure to do that by itself is reversible. He has to do that.
In determining what the evidence that you're relying on is large part Mr. Baca's own testimony, right?
No.
Well, a large part of it is.
No.
None of it is Mr. Baca's own testimony.
5%.
Well, could the AJ reject that 5% because there was he didn't believe that Mr. Baca was credible?
He's able to do that because he disregarded all the problems.
If he makes a determination that Mr. Baca is not credible, for example, Mr. Baca testified, I immediately interrupted the meeting and I said that you just battered him. Nobody in the meeting corroborates that, and they say it's patently untrue. The AJ listens to that and says, Mr. Baca's not credible. Isn't the AJ allowed to do that?
Mr. Alvidrez corroborated. Mr. Alvidrez was completely disregarded. I don't know why, but Mr. Alvidrez was present, and Mr. Alvidrez, there's 6 pages of his testimony that the judge pretended did not occur.
Well, isn't he the one that left?
Yes.
So he wasn't there to know whether Mr. Baca immediately after this slamming of the door happened said, how dare you batter him, this is outrageous, when there were only 3 people left in the room at that time, and 2 of them said, Baca's testimony isn't what happened.
And Mr. Alvidrez testified that he was injured.
Well, that's not what I'm asking.
That's the misconduct.
But what I'm asking is about credibility.
Yes, Your Honor. For an issue that occurred after the misconduct that does not reflect on the misconduct itself.
We don't make credibility determinations. Trial judges and ALJs don't make them as to one point. There was a finding. The ALJ determined that Mr. Baca was wholly incredible.
Your Honor, that's not the analysis. The analysis is what facts were known to him, and with those facts, the reasonable person to believe that misconduct occurred. Not whether the judge believes him or not. Whether there are facts that a reasonable person could conclude leads to that. Drake shows that it's reversible error to fail to do that analysis, and the judge fails to do that analysis. You have to ask what the facts are and identify whether a reasonable person would believe that misconduct occurred. There's no way that a reasonable person would not believe it. Having seen it, having heard from the victim, I got hurt by the phone call. And then there's an enormous amount of corroboration that shows that it actually occurred. So what the judge has done with this, he's stricken the weapon from Mr. Bach's hand, and then he's told Mr. Bach to defend himself. He's eliminated all of the evidence that shows that he's telling the truth, and then decided he doesn't believe Mr. Bach. It's deeply, deeply disturbing. If a person needs to prove that they have a reasonable belief that something occurred in a 7-Eleven, exclude the video showing that it happened, showing that they're there, and then disregard their testimony. The video shows the reasonable belief, and here the corroboration shows that the injury actually occurred, that he's telling the truth. So what he's done is he's, like I said, he's stripped the weapons from Mr. Bach's hands and then told him to defend himself. And that's under the D case. That's inappropriate. The corroboration needs to be at least considered. And if you read the initial decision, Mr. Alvidrez didn't offer any testimony about whether he was injured. That testimony is absent from the record. That is the corroboration that the misconduct occurred from the victim. If we can disregard victim testimony that they were injured, what is the point of the Whistleblower Protection Act in the first place? DOD 14.3806, violence, threats, harassment, intimidation, and other disruptive behavior will not be tolerated in the workplace. All reports of incidents will be taken seriously and will be dealt with appropriately. The undisputed evidence of Mr. Alvidrez is that no action was taken with regard to his complaint, even though he had medical records showing that it happened, even though he actually his incident was disregarded.
Was that the DODI instruction, was that presented to the administrative judge?
Not that particular rule. Theory that it was a rule.
Okay, but what do we do with the fact that the administrative judge wasn't alerted to that instruction? Even if you preserved your underlying theory to conclude that the adjudicator failed to apply a DOD instruction that nobody had told the administrative judge about, isn't that a problem?
I don't see that as a problem, Your Honor, because it was never an issue. There was no discussion about whether it was a rule or not. It was, to my mind, assumed that you can't do this in the workplace, and the judge's order does reflect that violence in the workplace would obviously be misconduct, and if you reported it, it would obviously be wrongful. So the fact that that regulation was not specifically cited was not an issue. The real problem is he just ignored that whole theory of relief entirely. I didn't address it. And 23 seconds left, I'd like to preserve those for
you. Bet. You bet. We'll hear from the appellee, or the respondent, rather. You accept IATA before you, your 15 minutes.
We've got a height differential here.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'd first like to address the contentions that are being made with regard to 2302E8A11I. That's the allegations regarding whether or not Mr. Baca had a reasonable belief. And if I could sum up what Mr. Baca is saying in his briefs, as he's saying today at oral argument, he's saying that the administrative judge had to accept Baca's view of reality in determining whether or not Baca had a reasonable belief. There's no support for that contention in the case law or the statute.
But apparently also arguing that there was other evidence, not just Mr. Baca's testimony, that was ignored.
Yes, yes, he is. But there's two issues. The first issue is what happened in the room, what happened in the office. And there, the testimony of Mr. Baca was not that he saw it. I mean, the court looks at the testimony, that's not what he said. He said he heard it. Mm-hmm. He said he heard two sounds, the first sound being what he took to be the door hitting Mr. Alvarez when he's inside the office, and then the second sound being the slamming of the door. The judge found to the contrary, that that did not happen, that if that was his perception was off. If that's his memory is bad.
Well, and what did the judge rely on in rejecting Mr. Baca's recollection of the two sounds?
Okay. The key finding of fact by the judge, and I'm going to answer your question, but the key finding is on page 725 of the Record on Appeal, and he finds there that, according to Mr. Alvarez, he was already on the other side of the door in the hallway when the door allegedly struck him, immediately walking away, admittedly walking away at the time. But that was Mr. Alvarez's statement. It was in his written statement. And if the court were to look, the citation there in the board's decision is to tab 20. At tab 20, that's the affirmative defenses that are amended. And with those amended affirmative defenses attached to it is the written statement of Mr. Alvarez. So the board did consider, the board judge did consider Mr. Alvarez's testimony and written statement, and that is consistent with all the other testimony, that being the testimony of Mr. Halls, the testimony of Ms. Pritchard, that Mr. Alvarez is not hit by the door in the office. That didn't happen.
Well,
he's already exited the office when the door closes such that it's in the shut.
Let's talk a minute about the medical evidence. You've got Mr. Alvarez's chiropractor reporting ongoing treatment for lumbar disc and joint degeneration. Is there anything in the medical records that says, and this was caused by being hit with a door?
Yes. What happened was that Mr. Alvarez, after exiting the office, then goes to the Department of Emergency Services and makes a report that Ms. Pritchard assaulted and battered him. And then he goes to the clinic, which is right there at the facility, and he claims that he was assaulted by Ms. Pritchard. There's no medical record from that visit to the clinic. You only have Mr. Alvandra's testimony, and you have the report of the investigation, where it's reported in the investigation that Mr. Alvandra's claims that pictures were taken, and the doctor claims that no such pictures were taken. And basically, what Mr. Alvandra is saying is not corroborated. As I said, there were two issues, what went on in the room and what went on after Mr. Alvarez exits the office and he's in the hallway. Now, the judge also found that right then and there, after the door slammed shut, Mr. Baca claims, this is his testimony, he claims that he immediately accuses Ms. Pritchard of an assault and battery, and that Mr. Holmes immediately agrees, and that he then ceases the meeting and the meeting is over. Well, the judge found that didn't happen. Either he's got a bad memory, or as the judge said, this is his fantasy, it's some sort of delusion on his part, but it just didn't happen.
Well, the judge didn't just say, I don't believe you. The judge believed other witnesses.
That's true, but he also looked to the plausibility of the story that Mr. Baca was telling. He did look to other witnesses' testimony. He looked to the statements that had been written at the time. Mr. Holtz wrote a statement shortly after this incident on March 7th. And that statement, that written statement that Mr. Holmes has quoted at length in the judge's decision. And the judge credits Mr. Holmes' testimony and his written statement. Nothing happened. Anybody that was in the room could not have concluded that Mr. Alvandra's was hit by the door. That's the factual finding on page 725 of the record on appeal. So, as I said, essentially what Mr. Bob is saying on appeal is that you have to accept his view of reality. There's no support for that in the law. What the case law says, and we cited the decisions from the Federal Circuit and from the Ninth Circuit, is it's proper for the administrative judge to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses, including the credibility of the petitioner, the alleged whistleblower. That's perfectly proper under the case law. And that's what the judge did in this case. And what we're saying is that to have a reasonable belief, it has to be grounded in some facts. You don't have to know everything, but you have to have some basis in fact. And what the judge found is that Mr. Bonko's belief was not grounded in the real facts. And if I can turn to the second alleged error on appeal, this is the contention that Mr. Baca established reprisal pursuant to 2302B9B. Now, what he's saying, I think the court is aware of this, that he came within this provision because he provided assistance to Mr. Alvarez. Now, what I just wanted to clarify for the court.
Now, you mean Mr. Holes? That Mr. Baca came to the assistance of Mr. Alvarez?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. Okay, I'm with you. All right.
That's the contention. Now, what I just wanted to clarify, this is very clear in the judge's decision, if it's read carefully. The finding is that Mr. Baca attempted to intimidate Mr. Holes. The finding is not that Mr. Holes was in fact intimidated and gave a statement pursuant to instructions of Mr. Baca. It's that he was Mr. Baca attempted to intimidate. Now, it's our contention that on the facts, it is not lawful for someone, a supervisor, to attempt to intimidate your subordinate to give a written statement. And there's full substantial evidence in the record for the judge's finding. There's a 3-hour meeting in Mr. Hull's office with Mr. Hull's and Mr. Baca and Ms. Montoya. She's got the office right next door, and she hears through the wall parts of the conversation. And the judge notes in particular Ms. Montoya's assertion and testimony and written statement that Mr. Baca at one point says something and Mr. Hull responds, I'm not going to write that. So there's full substantial evidence for the finding that there's an attempt on Mr. Baca's part to intimidate Mr. Hull.
What about Mr. Hull's testimony that he wasn't intimidated?
Well, what Mr. Hull says was that he was made to feel uncomfortable. And that testimony is credited by the judge. He felt uncomfortable through this process. What he said in particular was he didn't know whether Mr. Baca wanted me to lie or was trying to get me to lie. That's the testimony.
Isn't it true, though, that that the administrative judge, I don't want to, were you through answering Judge McHugh? I didn't want to talk over your answer, but I had a question.
I just wanted to go on to the other points.
Okay, but before you do that, can I ask you a question about this?
Yes.
This very point? Isn't it true that the administrative judge never actually discussed Mr. Baca's theory that he was removed in retaliation for trying to help talking to Mr. Oles to try to induce him to give a statement?
Yes, that's true.
Well, if the administrative judge never made a finding, and Mr. Baca presented that theory to the administrative judge, how do we avoid remanding so that the administrative judge can decide that in the first instance?
Now, first of all, he did make the finding that there was an intent to intimidate. He made the factual finding. What he didn't do is go further. Now, we're saying that there's two reasons why this court should not remand. Number one, there's been a waiver. During the proceeding, Mr. Baca ignored part of his burden. Part of his burden is to show that Mr. Alfiedras had exercised a complaint, appeal, or grievance right granted by any law, rule, or regulation. That part of his prima facie case is totally ignored. And he's trying to make up for the gap in the record by now pointing to two directives, the DOD instruction and the Army Headquarters policy.
Well, aren't those any law?
Excuse me?
Isn't that any law?
We're not contending that those are rules, they're not regulations, they're not laws, but they're certainly rules. But he did not bring this to the attention of the administrative judge. And in a sense, what he's done is he's prejudiced the government. Because had he made the arguments that he's making now, we would have responded in full. And as we did in our brief, what we pointed out is these arguments, they are not sufficient under MSPC case law. Number one, a complaint of a workplace injury is not within the provision of the statute.
Excuse me.
And that's MSPB case law. Number two, a complaint of a criminal charge. One employee makes an allegation that another employee has assaulted and battered him also does not come within this provision. What the MSPB has pointed out is this provision deals with proceedings that employees bring against their employer where they're seeking a remedy for a violation of their employment rights. And Mr. Alfiedras never did that. He never filed a grievance. He never filed any sort of challenge that would lead to a personal remedy. All he did was make a criminal charge, and that criminal charge resulted in an investigation. If that investigation had resulted in a finding that there was an assault and battery, Ms. Pritchard could have been criminally prosecuted or fired. But Mr. Albiadis could never get any personal remedy for any violation of his employment rights because he hasn't done anything that comes within the statute. But I'm sorry, I see I'm over it up.
Do you have any questions, Carol?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Very briefly.
Well, before we start your clock.
Okay. Extremely briefly, the medical record evidence is at volume one of the ROA at 461 and volume at 462. Recommend 10 days of sick leave due to back injury sustained with public joint degeneration for injury sustained resettlement.
Thank you very much, counsel. This matter will be submitted. Appreciate fine advocacy of both sides. Court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.